From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. We're coming to you from the historic Belknap Mill in Laconia, built in 1823 and described as the country's oldest unaltered brick textile mill. And so it seems a perfect place to host our conversation about preserving New Hampshire's past, specifically our buildings. This hour, we'll explore what's worth saving and what isn't, how to make these old structures usable, not just museum pieces, and what are the costs and benefits of doing so. We'll also take questions from our live audience, and we have four guests. They are Jennifer Goodman, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Preservation Alliance, and Jen, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Also with us, Jared Gilmet. He's Vice Chair of the Belknap Mill Society. He's also an architectural designer at the Mushashik Turpin firm in Laconia. And Jared, really nice to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Also with us, Elizabeth Muzzy, Director of the New Hampshire Division of Historical Resources and State Historic Preservation Officer. And Elizabeth, thank you also.
Pleasure to be here.
And also, last but not least, Justin Slattery, Executive Director at the Belknap Economic Development Council. He's also overseeing the Colonial Theater restoration project in downtown Laconia. And Justin, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and Elizabeth, I'm going to start with you. When we talk about protecting and preserving historic buildings like this one that we're in right now, let's define historic. How old does something have to be considered historic?
That's a great question. A lot of people assume something has to be very old, whether that's 100 or 200 years old, but I need to let you all know that we begin to look at buildings when they're about 50 years old to get an idea as to what is their history, how do they fit into the larger history of an area, and so a lot of the buildings we're looking at right now were built in the 1960s. There are things like ranch houses and that type of architecture that you might remember from your youth.
So how do you discern what's valuable then in terms of historic value? Okay, so something's 50 years old. I guess that's the number. Is there a cultural significance? Something big happened here? I mean, what other metrics do you use to decide that something really is an important historic property?
Well, within the architectural history profession, we have regular standards and criteria that we use, and it looks at not only the architecture of a building, but also its history, how does it fit into a community. But really what matters is what the community feels about the building. If someone comes to us and say, we care about this building, we feel it's important, obviously we agree with that and we work with them and try to help make their goals come to fruition.
I'd love your thoughts too, Jen, on this. What's historic and what isn't, especially in a state like New Hampshire where a lot of the buildings are old?
Right. I mean, we have lobsters to one side of us and cows to the other, and I think our history, what all kinds of history, is really what makes New Hampshire, New Hampshire. Our muscular mill buildings, our great villages and wonderful farms, all kinds of things. I would just add to what Beth said in terms of looking for that significance, that it is often, could be connected to famous events, could be connected to important people, could have to do with continuity and development over time. And like Beth said, you sort of take almost the academic significance, mix in what the community is interested in, as she said, and then add that component of economic vitality and viability. That's often what we look at, the significance, community, and the economic part.
I
of it
see.
Too.
So there's a lot of pieces that you're looking at, Jen, not just age, but what happened here, what does it look like? Is it important to the community, especially in terms of economic development?
Right. We just gave awards, and I could just give you some examples
sure.
of kind of the range of history we're talking about. The Preservation Achievement Awards from the New Hampshire Preservation Alliance went to everything from a cemetery fence, a wonderful cast iron fence around a cemetery in Holderness, New Hampshire, to a gas station in Lebanon that had been converted into a coffee shop, a big mill, the Franklin Power and Light Mill in Franklin, New Hampshire, and a 1930s church. So all kinds of scale, all kinds of history, but important to those communities, able to be economically viable and treasured part of that image of New Hampshire.
So economic viability, of course, I'm going to look to you next, Justin, as head of the Belknap Economic Development Council. a big part of your job. I'm reading from the website here, retaining and attracting young talent, enhancing workforce development. So how do historic buildings help with those goals?
They really are an important feature of the work we're doing on a day-to-day basis here in the Lakes region and working with our communities. Obviously, we have many historic downtowns, just like here in Laconia, and it was referenced the Colonial Theater restoration project that we're working on now in partnership with many, including the city of Laconia, to bring the theater back to life. But what's important is to note a project like the Colonial Theater really is an anchor, and a restored facility will really drive more economic activity, whether indirect or direct, from an open theater. So a lot of times when we are looking at historic preservation projects, the Economic Development Council is looking at it from the community development or economic development standpoint of how we can leverage resources to build economic opportunity. So it's very important for us here in the Lakes region. I think throughout the state, a lot of my colleagues are working on historic preservation projects because they're good for our communities and good for economic development.
And I definitely want to ask you about the Laconia, the Colonial Theater
sure.
project in a minute, but here we are again at the Belknap Mill. So what has the restoration and preservation of this building, and it's lovely, what has that meant to the economic vitality of Laconia?
Well, I think speaking to the mill here, and I know many folks here in the audience and others that have worked so hard over many years to save the mill and to preserve it and have it be another anchor, if you will, here in Laconia. It's a place that brings people together, a sense of community. It's a place that people get married at, the Rotary meets at. It's a meeting place. It represents the past, but it also is the future, I think, here and represents American history here as well. And I think that's why that's so important, that this is really one piece of the fabric of I know the Industrial Revolution, but it's serving a purpose for the community here in the region here in 2018.
So an adaptive reuse,
yes.
And I know that's something that you look at, Jared. You're an architectural designer. How hard is it to make old buildings usable for modern users?
It really varies depending on the scale of the projects, just like Jennifer was referencing. You know, it could be anything from a small cabin to a 1930s church. And those all come with their own kind of difficulties. And it really, it needs a team to evaluate that, whether it's working with structural engineers or energy performance reviews, that how do you work with these historic windows that are still in beautiful condition, but allow the space to be inhabitable in the winter? Or how can they be operable enough so that you can still get ventilation in the summer when you gets really hot? So it really is a thorough evaluation that needs to happen. You know, here with the mill, we recently did a historic building assessment, and that allowed us to understand exactly what aspects of this mill can work and how can we productively revitalize the space so that it can meet the needs of today while also still embodying every aspect of its historic integrity that means so much to the community. So it really is independent for each project and what it means for the community that it's in, and how that can be tackled from an architectural design standpoint.
Now, that's interesting. So what do you find in your experience often becomes difficult, problematic when it comes to adaptive reuse for these old buildings? Is it you find yourself saying, oh, this heating system just isn't going to work, or, oh, these windows just aren't going to work, or we can't be here because of we used to use lead paint or asbestos. I mean, what are some of the typical bugaboos that you run into?
Well, you hit on quite a few good ones.
Okay.
Right there. but I would say, too, that there's a lot of accessibility issues with how can you allow for wheelchair accessibility or just easier mobility or even for a hearing impairment. How can you help these individuals still be able to use these buildings and partake in the community or live in them? If it's their home, how can you adapt that space so that they can live in it? And that's where you sometimes are faced with compromise of how can I work to still preserve this fabric but address a floor change? You know, there's four steps leading into the house. All right, how can I add a ramp without destroying the site that is on or destroying the door entry threshold? So it can be challenging, but it can always be accomplished.
Do you want to jump in, Beth?
Following up on what Jared said about a historic building assessment, I think is really key, and it's something that we're seeing more and more with preservation projects in the state, and that's combining a team of different professionals, engineers, architects, builders, architectural historians, and taking a look at the building and seeing what is the next best use for that building. Because if a compatible reuse is put into a building, there doesn't need to be a lot of change. The updates are something we've done before, and we know how to do them. That's a terrific, fairly easy project. It's when some of that pre-planning may not happen, and it's trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. Things become a lot tougher.
Someone looks at a building and says, oh, that would make great affordable housing, but maybe you just can't do that. Go ahead, Jen, real quick, and then we're going to go to our audience.
Just even step back a little further when you're looking at the challenges that you two described perspectives on and how to overcome really well. I would just take a step back and say that oftentimes underlying planning and zoning are a thing that need to be updated and put in alignment with the community's goals to then allow these individual building redevelopment projects to happen.
So I see.
So often underlying issues related to land use. And then, there's market forces that are making some of these harder, too, right? People are living and working in different ways than they were when these buildings were built.
Sure. So sometimes it's not a physical problem like asbestos or lead. It's more a political problem in that the community isn't zoned to make it amenable to refurbishing or reusing that building. Lots more to talk about. I want to also go to our audience, though, here at the Belknap Mill. And good evening. We've got someone at the microphone with a question.
Yes, my name is Carl. I'm from Samberton. And I know LCHIP is a state grant program that's pretty remarkable. But I'm wondering if there are other grant programs in the state that historic preservation can take advantage of.
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Carl, because as we talk about barriers to this, money, right? That's probably the big one. So first of all, Jennifer, if you could just please, for people who aren't familiar, what is LCHIP?
Yeah, it's an incredible investment program, the Land and Community Heritage Investment Program, developed by historic preservation organizations like ours, conservation organizations, and the legislature 18 years ago. It's had an incredible run investing in community projects around the state. This one, right? The Colonial Theater, and many others probably associated with the people in the audience. So available to nonprofit and municipal projects, matching just the stories of the how catalytic this program has been through the years is incredible. I think on the historic preservation side, for every dollar in from LCHIP, five or more has been spent. Great supporting local jobs, great in terms of being a catalyst for the next thing happening after the LCHIP project, too.
Well, and Carl's question, too, asked about what else is there besides LCHIP. So, Beth, what else is there?
Another important grant program that people often use with LCHIP is the Conservation License Plate Program, which if you're all familiar with the moose plates that you see across the state, and I hope you all have a moose plate on your vehicles. Our office runs a smaller grant program that is available to publicly owned buildings for rehabilitation projects, bricks and mortar projects. We look at it as often the starter program for folks that may go on to a larger program with LCHIP. It's often a good way for people to get used to the grant process and how that works. Another important type of funding are incentives. And we can talk about preservation tax incentives and local property tax incentives as well.
Well, and is Laconia doing that, Justin, to promote this, again, Colonial Theater restoration project?
Yes, in particular with the Colonial Theater project, we've worked very closely with Beth and her team and the LCHIP folks as well and other organizations focused on historic preservation. But historic tax credits are an important piece of the Colonial Theater funding. And so we've worked very closely with the team at the State Historic Preservation Office, really from the beginning of the project. We're the Economic Development Council, and we have to lean on many, many partners that know a lot more about, you know, historic preservation specifically. So that's been a great resource for us, and also working with the National Park Service and others.
Go ahead, Jared.
So just following up on what Justin was saying about the Colonial Theaters working with NHDHR and putting together this historic tax credit and trying to list the building on the National Register. At Meschashik Turpin, we're the architects on that team, so we've been working very closely with Peter and his team, as well as the owners, to get this to move forward. And it's been an extremely fun process that's also been very rigorous. And I think sometimes it gets a lot of flack for being super focused on maintaining every historical detail, but there's a reason that we evaluate it that way, so that we can make sure that our end result is more beautiful and really expressive of the history and the meaning of what that building was to the community.
You know, getting back really quickly to the issue of accessibility, as one of you mentioned earlier, these old buildings are sometimes not very friendly to people in wheelchairs, walkers. New Hampshire's an older state, so I don't see this issue going away. And real quick, Jared, what are some of the challenges in getting historic buildings up to current accessibility standards? Or do historic buildings have to meet those standards? Maybe they're off the hook, I don't know.
So code-wise, there is some leniency in historic buildings and not necessarily meeting every need of modern code. One example is stairs. You know, we have certain heights of the rise and lengths of the tread that we need to meet when building today, but the historic buildings, they kind of just sometimes threw them up with whatever wood they had around. So the heights can really vary, and that can be a trip hazard. So you do need to evaluate that closely to say, well, yes, this is historic, but am I going to trip on this? Is somebody really going to hurt themselves? So you know, there's a lot of kind of evaluating these odd little areas, but even space-wise, how can I fit an elevator in here without taking out 20 windows? Or how can I, you know, how can you make it work without really destroying that fabric? So that's kind of...
It's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Justin, to you, I mean, you talked about the importance of having a community space, and here we are at the Belknap Mill, and people have parties here, people get married here, and so forth. So you want it to be welcoming to the community. But if a segment of your community, you know, can't get up the stairs, how do you make it a community place?
Yes, it's... You know, it goes back to working with experts like my fellow panelists here and really working on a design that allows for that accessibility and also meeting the rigorous standards, I think, of what's demanded of historical preservation type projects. So it's a real balancing act. But I think organizations, you know, like Belknap EDC, and we're looking at ways to, you know, to work with our partners and develop, you know, projects that can provide that good economic development impact that we're looking to have. And so you right here in this property here, you see how it's been adapted to have a use in modern times from its original manufacturing site. So
we're here at the Belknap Mill in Laconia. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Now, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9, on NHPR.
Again, The Exchange is on the road today at the historic Belknap Mill. We're talking about preserving New Hampshire's historic buildings, the benefits, the costs, also these structures' role in our local economies. And we're talking about how we prioritize what's worth saving, what isn't. We have four guests. We're taking questions from our audience, too. And I'd like to go to another audience member now. Good evening, sir. Thank you for turning out.
Good evening. My name is Glenn. I live in Kingston, New Hampshire. And The question revolves around economics of historic preservation, because for folks who are interested in the subject and invested in it in some way, it's an easy sell. But there's a segment of folks out there who might feel that historic preservation is wasteful. There are other better uses of the money, and so I'd like to know from the panelists, how do you build a value proposition to make the argument, and how do you build that economic impact perspective to make the sell and gain the support and ultimately the funding that you need for these projects?
Justin, it's a business economic development question, so go to you first, but anybody else jump in as well. Go ahead.
Well, it's a great question from Glenn.
Making the case, yeah.
I think we're fortunate here in Laconia, working with Mayor Engler and his leadership and many community leaders that have focused on projects like the Colonial Theater and how we move those forward. But really, people like myself, economic developers, it's a case we make every day on different projects. So we have tools that we can use and resources to build the economic analysis, to build the business case studies, to show that it makes sense, you know, to invest in a project like the Colonial or like the Belknap Mill. Makes good economic development sense because of the catalytic nature of that investment in driving people that, you know, if you think of the theater renovated and open, people grabbing a bite to eat or going to a show or coming into town, visiting town and coming to see something in cultural arts, it can make a lot of sense. But economic development councils and regional corporations like Belknap EDC, you know, we have to look at the project and analyze it and make sure it makes sense for the community.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from others on this too. So Jen, make the case, the idea that not just if we had a theater in town, it would be great because people would come and see the show and get a bite, but an old theater, a historically preserved theater. So make that case to the average person who may not be as interested.
Yeah.
Maybe some examples would be good.
Right. I was actually going to go back to Kingston, actually, the town where Glenn lives, and talk about that. I guess, you know, historic preservation is a movement more than one discipline, and it totally intersects with all these interrelated fields of housing and community and economic development and conservation. There's lots of studies that show that the local historic district that is in a place like that Kingston has, a local historic district, actually that designation enhances values. It's easy to imagine that the labor-intensive nature of preservation work, right? The local guys buying local wood, using labor to fix that bandstand is keeping a lot of money circulating in the local economy. Study after study shows that rehabilitation work is better for the economy than new construction because of that labor intensity that leads to circulating the dollars in a local economy. So those are just a few examples of many. Heritage visitors stay longer and spend more, great with that labor intensity, keeping that money local, and as an enhancer to private property values too. Historic preservation has all of that going for it and much more.
Because sometimes, and I'll turn to you, Elizabeth, again, historic theaters, they're beautiful and people love to see them, but we might have better acoustics in a new building. So again, make the case that it's worth it economically, as Glenn asks, to preserve a historic building, to do that adaptive reuse that Jared talked about.
The one community that I think of in New Hampshire, if any of you folks have been to New Market recently, if you look at New Market today versus what New Market was like, say, 40 years ago or 50 years ago, recently a very large-scale project rehabilitating that mill using tax credits. Others got interested in the idea of that type of development. A blacksmith shop next door, something slated for demolition, has now been rehabilitated with the new addition of some new condominiums that are very sympathetic with the surrounding historic buildings. There's more business on Main Street, there's more traffic on Main Street, more restaurants, more stores opening, and it's that catalytic effect that I believe we were just talking about a few minutes ago that's so important. And that catalytic effect can be studied and quantified, not here in New Hampshire, but in many other states, many other communities have actually had economic impact studies that have looked at the specific economics of restoring old buildings, restoring older neighborhoods and what that will produce for a community, not only from an economic standpoint, but a quality of life standpoint as well.
So wait, why can't that be quantified in New Hampshire?
Well, it absolutely could be quantified in New Hampshire, and I'm hoping that happens soon, because it does... It really presents very interesting information. The National Trust has done a study called Older, Smaller, Better, and using very interesting ways of quantifying this, including cell phone usage and that type of thing in older neighborhoods with smaller human-scaled buildings, walkable, more dense neighborhoods. And it's fascinating what they've been able to determine.
Did you want to jump in too, Jared, on this question, great question that Glenn asks? Make the case to someone who's less interested.
Sure. I'll just add briefly that kind of with a question of, can you put a price to maintaining, growing, and developing your community's identity? Because a lot of these buildings are what our city's fabrics are made of, and imagine that city or town without them. And what would that look like? Would it be better? Would it be worse? And they all are a part of who we are as a community, how we all work together, how we all interact with each other, and how we can make each other a stronger place. So sometimes the investment needs to be made. That, sure, it's a little bit more expensive now, but as we're talking, like, there's that return on investment in so many of these instances where it increases the growth of the economy.
Well, let's take another question for our audience, and thank you so much for that one, Glenn, and thank you for being here. Go ahead, please.
Welcome to Historic Belknap Mill. We're delighted that you're here. My name is Dorothy Duffy. I live in Laconia. I'm one of the members of the Laconia Heritage Commission. We're completely represented here, but I'm speaking in my own behalf. Right now, the city is having a master plan upgrade, and in that master plan, the heritage of the community is always a very important element. It seems like it's always mentioned or improved in words, but we can't seem to do the deeds. We, for example, have been on the Heritage Commission for 10 years, and we haven't been very successful in saving some of the buildings that we'd like to save. For example, we have a Church Street. In another year or so, we may not have a church on Church Street.
Wow. So politicians, elected officials talk a good game, Dorothy, but when it gets down to it, you don't feel like their values are in the right place when it comes to historic preservation.
I think it's like the arts come last. I think the heritage of a community comes last, that everything seems to be more important. The other thing that I think we encounter is that while we're very dedicated, we may not have the expertise that is needed for boards and commissions. And unfortunately, the right people don't apply.
Well, let's talk about that. And I'm guessing, Jennifer, that this is a complaint that you hear in other communities. You know, elected officials talk a good game, but when it comes down to it, it's cheaper and easier to, you know, put up a Rite Aid and get all the tax money from that, too.
Right.
Nothing right. against Rite Aid, by the way.
Right. I mean, there's about four questions in there and lots of really interesting points
thank you,
and
Dorothy.
Issues. I mean, I feel lucky to be in New Hampshire, where I feel like there is sort of this embedded commitment to place and civic responsibility. So I would start there in a very positive way. I think with historic preservation or many other things in a community, it is really hard to fill those volunteer boards, keep people trained. It's just a constant. So I'm sympathetic. We hear that all the time. Hope the Preservation Alliance and Division of Historical Resources and your neighboring communities can provide a lift for that, but I recognize it is a struggle. In terms of the money issue,
And the political will. Everybody says, that's nice, but do they put actions and resources behind those words?
We're not winning and we're not saving everything for sure. But again, I would say that... it's good we have civic responsibility and commitment to place, yet we're dealing in a state with structural issues in terms of how we pay for things. So a lot of it does come back to that. Heavy reliance on property tax, very lean state government, that obviously trickles down into everything, including historic preservation. I do want to say I'm going back and forth with pros and cons. The Preservation Alliance and our partners have really built a toolbox of tools over the last 10 or 15 years, including some of the tax incentives we just talked about, land and community heritage investment program. And that's been incredible momentum, and that's been because of legislators, state legislators on both sides of the aisle, big town, big cities, small towns, committed to building the toolbox so we all can do more at the local level. And I think we keep track of what happens at city council and town meetings, and we just had another great year. So I know that doesn't solve everything for everybody, but I feel like we're in a really positive trend around things like that.
Well, and Justin, for you, you know, people have been talking about the Colonial Theater for a long time. My understanding is, you know, you're still working on it, but it hasn't started yet. So how are you finding the, again, the resources backing up the political will for this project? You know, everybody says, yes, yes, we want it, but are they backing that up with dollars?
They are. As Jennifer said, you know, we're working, you know, closely with the city here, who's a key funding partner to the project, and many of the organizations like the Preservation Alliance and Historic Department of Historic Preservation, the LCHIP program, are very, very fortunate to receive a significant grant award from the LCHIP organization, in the Community Development Finance Authority, and other organizations that we work with. We have found a supportive community with that project, and I think our local residents and others that have supported the capital campaign as well. So I think a lot of times it's the New Hampshire way. You know, we may all be frugal Yankees, but we do have a great sense of pride in our communities and are committed to growing our communities and working together. And I think a lot of times at Belknap EDC, we've been able to work with our partners and build the case for that project and build the funding as well. So I think it's always important to build that partnership.
It's pretty local, Elizabeth, isn't it, really? I mean, the state, you know, can identify important places. It can kick in a little money with LCHIP, but it seems to me most of this has to happen at the local level.
Well, they say all preservation is local because all of our places that we care about are also different, and they're all individual to our own communities, our own towns and cities. One thing that I have seen that communities do that's very successful, although they may be worried about a particular property, the idea of sharing their town's history and how that's illustrated by the buildings and parks and structures that are in your community. So thinking of the city of Keene, right now they're running a wonderful lecture series that talks about the architectural history of Keene, different aspects, the agricultural history of Keene, but then taking folks on walking tours too and getting people out there to experience historic places and to tell the stories and have people be swayed by those places that we all feel are so special. So sometimes it's just taking one step back and trying to make the broader case. So when that emergency situation comes into town, you've got a little bigger group of people who are saying, yeah, I understand. I think that's important too. And another thing is, if you do that type of programming, to make sure your local officials come, somehow convince them to be there, whether it takes a free ticket or food or whatever. but get them out there, too, so they can see the special places through your eyes.
Well, and from what I understand, the mayor of Laconia is here, and the tickets were free to this event, and we do have food afterwards. So there you go. We also have a great live audience here, and I'd love to go back to that audience. So thank you for turning out, and go ahead with your question, please.
Hi, I'm Robert Perot from Manchester, and I want to thank you for having me on. I'm also the author of a recent book of my photographs of Manchester showing landmarks that have been torn down in the last 40 years. And my question is, in Manchester, historically and architecturally significant buildings have sometimes been demolished with little or no advance public warning, such as our old B&M railroad station in 1962. Then Mayor John Mongan found out about it when someone went to City Hall and told him on the first day of demolition, "Did you know there's a wrecking crew at the railroad station?" Mongan had no idea, and he was mayor. What can be done to stop this sort of crime against our cultural heritage?
Well, Robert, it's great to see you, and thank you for being out. And there's a similar story where I live in Concord. There was a beautiful railway station that was torn down, and now today everybody says, gosh, why did we do that? So, Elizabeth, I'm going to turn to you first on that. When a building is considered historic, what are the public's rights to know what's going on with that building, to maybe even defend that building?
That's a very, very broad question. And in New Hampshire, I think much of the preservation success and activity is done by private property owners who care and love about their properties and take care of them and steward them every day and for generations. And they are free to do what they would like with their properties without any interference, even if their property has attained what we would think of some sort of historical status, such as listing on the New Hampshire State Register of Historic Places. There are some communities in New Hampshire that have demo review ordinances, meaning someone such as the Laconia Heritage Commission would have some advance notice before a building is demolished, and they would have an opportunity to work with that property owner to see whether there's an alternative. And we've had some successes. Many communities in New Hampshire have that type of ordinance, and it can be helpful in certain cases. In Concord, we have a great success of a barn that was slated for removal to head out west to be someone's ski mansion, and the community got together, and due to the demo review ordinance, that barn is still a landmark in Concord.
Jen, I'd love to hear from you, too, on this. Lots of lists and designations, the National Register of Historic Places, the 7 to Save that we have here in New Hampshire, other lists that have come up. If a property is on one of these historically significant lists, is it getting more protection from demolition? Does it have more rights than other types of properties?
The 7 to Save program is one of the New Hampshire Preservation Alliance's programs. We've been doing it for 10 years. It's a public nomination process. If there's something in your community that you're concerned about, you can submit it. And we look at the significance, the threats, the opportunity for 7 to Save to make a difference. The Colonial Theater was one of those examples. It's really a communication tool to help raise public awareness. Often people are working hard in their community, and to kind of give it a boost and give it statewide attention is helpful in terms of attracting new investment, convincing folks on the local level, securing additional dollars, things like that. I just would mention that back to the question about what happens when a demolition is imminent. I think Beth's themes about communication and possibly using a planning tool are right on. And I just wanted to add that some citizens around the state have been doing great things recently, kind of taking a page from the land conservation book and buying properties that were in jeopardy, holding them until a new use or owner could be found, a village store, an old town hall, things like that. Or doing the easement equivalent on the historic preservation side for a historic building, similar again to the conservation world.
Elizabeth,
to the
go
National
ahead, and
Register
then I have another question
Register,
yeah,
let,
for you, Jared. Go ahead, Elizabeth. Did you want to jump on sort of what rights does a historic building have when it comes to demolition, if any?
So the two programs that our office works with, ways for people to recognize the historical places that matter to them, are the New Hampshire State Register of Historic Places and the National Register of Historic Places. Both of those are what we call honorific programs, and the vast majority of people who wish to list their properties on them do it because they love their buildings and they want that public recognition that this place matters. That said, those property owners are free to do and care for their buildings in the manner that they see best. So if we want to think about whether the building has any rights, that type of recognition is beneficial in many ways, but it does not restrict what that owner can do for the building.
So, Jared, from a practical standpoint, when we talk about adaptive reuse of historic buildings like the one we're in now, the Belknap Mill, when you want to preserve that historic character, and here at the mill, you can go downstairs, you can see the wheels, you can see the machinery, How much does someone who wants to adaptively use a historic building have to follow all sorts of, you know, fussy details to make sure it's absolutely perfect? And how much leeway does he or she have when it comes to adaptive reuse?
Sure. Again, it's kind of one of those dependent questions here with the mill.
Sure.
We have worked closely with LCHIP and NHDHR over the years, and we have a working easement with them. So here in this building, we have to get every kind of modification that we'd like to do approved with them so that it maintains that character, that it's not going to destroy any aspect of the significant quality, as it is one of the few remaining mills in this part of Laconia that still stands from its original use in this area.
So how hard is that to do? What sort of can't you do that you might want to do, but you have to stick with this historical interpretation?
It's very much a working process, and planning is really what is productive, planning and conversations, that you don't just throw something at the doors of the state offices and say, this is what I want to do, that you work with them from the beginning to say, these are our thoughts, what are your, you know, how can we make this a stronger process? And exactly like what we did with the historic building assessment through LCHIP, that we really worked in a very integrated manner of, okay, these are the areas that are wrong or need help, and what can we do? So generating as a team ideas that can be productive in this adaptive reuse and in renovations to maintain that character, but also bring it to the needs of today.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. We're coming to you from the Belknap Mill in Laconia. We're talking about the benefits, costs, and challenges of preserving New Hampshire's historic buildings. We have a live audience here in Laconia along with four guests. And before we go back to the audience, Justin, I did want to ask you also about, you know, how you keep the historic character of these buildings, but bring them up to modern uses. That's kind of where we started talking about. Are there things, for example, that you'd like to do with the Colonial Theater to make it acceptable for modern audiences that you're running into problems because of the historic character? For example, maybe you need handicap accessible bathrooms. Maybe you need a better air conditioning system. I'd just love a couple examples.
Sure, that's a great point. I think just seconding what my fellow panelists have talked about, you know, it's working with the designers to build a plan and to build a project that meets modern amenities, but in a historic facility. So, and what we've really tried to do with the design, specifically with the Colonial, it's a 104-year-old building that is getting, you know, rebuilt here in 2018, and it's really, really looking at the design and the functionality of the space, to, you know, to meet modern demands, if you will. So it's a real give and take. I know, as I've been working through the Colonial Theater project, and probably Jared and the other panelists can speak to this as well, is some of the modern designs that have been added, the modern handicap accessible bathrooms or elevators or entrances. You know, they are, you know, to meet historic standards, they need to look new, which is interesting. And maybe it goes a little counterintuitive to what you would think, or someone like myself that's not a historical preservationist, building that design to have those elements within the design has been very interesting, you know, and I think Jared, knowing he's worked on the project, can speak to that as well a little bit.
So, but sticking with that historic designation, maybe it's on the list of historic, the National Register of Historic Places. Jared, does it tie your hands, or do you have a fair bit of flexibility in terms of putting in those modern amenities?
It's a little bit of both, and it, I feel like I keep saying that.
That's okay. Every project is different. No, I understand.
Because, and what Justin was saying, you know, what we're doing where we're putting new elevators in or new fully handicap accessible bathrooms that also meet the capacity of the building and meet that code regulation, not that they have to look new, but they have to be discernible and compatible, that they need to work with that fabric so that they just strengthen it, that it really feels like this is a successful remodel and renovation of preserving this building.
Elizabeth, so would a building owner hesitate to get his or her building on the National Register of Historic Places or a local list because he or she might think, if I have that special historic designation, I won't be able to do anything. I'm wondering if it's how much it's a help, I'm sure it is, and how much is it a hindrance in terms of, again, bringing it up to modern desires?
The general rule of thumb is if you need to update a building, if you need a modern kitchen, if you need good plumbing, by all means, you know, please add that to your building, because a building that is well-used and well-loved will be cared for, and so we want you to enjoy your buildings. But if you're interested in preserving the historic nature of that building, add that bathroom, add that kitchen in a way that preserves what the most historic fabric possible, and is compatible with the building, because we can't get that old fabric back. We're not going to get something that's 200 years old back again. Okay. When it's gone, it's gone.
Let's go back to our audience. We have a couple other people with questions, and thank you for being here. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm Linda Frawley, and thank you to New Hampshire Public Radio, and especially the panelists. I happen to be from Belmont, and you have heavily invested in time, care, and funding in our town over the last 40 years since the Belmont Mill was saved. My question, looking at your work statewide, is what the secret sauce is that makes preservation work in some communities, and in others, it's a town-by-town debate.
I love that. Secret sauce. Thank you so much. And I actually would like to go down the line on this, starting with Justin and just moving on down. What's the secret sauce? Some communities, you go there, you know they've got it.
Yeah.
And others, it's kind of everybody just, maybe it doesn't work out so well. Let's put it that way. So cool. Thank you so much for the question. Go ahead, Justin.
Well, I think it's a great question from Linda. I think all our communities do have a little bit of different styles, if you will, maybe different attitudes, but I have found what works the best is communities that are communicating well. They got the right attitude that they're all on the same team, if you will. And what we have seen that's been successful is when a community has thought through where are they and where are they heading? What's their vision? And I think a lot of times historic preservation projects or economic development projects can really follow that vision that a community has. And so a lot of times what I have found is it's really simple. It's a good attitude. It's good communication. It's working together to move your community forward. I think that's what you see around the state.
Who else do you think has the secret sauce?
Say that again?
Of course you're going to say Laconia's got it. But who else do you, what other communities do you look at for inspiration, you know, Justin, when you do this work? You go, wow, that's a very inspiring community in terms of its commitment to historic preservation.
Oh, well, let's see. Tilton, Belmont, no, every,
oh,
every town in Belknap
towns.
County.
Okay.
And then the Lakes region. But I think Concord, Keene, Portsmouth. I think of many towns like that that really they have that secret sauce, and I think you can see from an outsider like myself, you know, that they're moving forward, they're making progress, and you see that a lot. But I think here in the Lakes region, we have great communities to work with, and that makes my job a lot easier. So,
Jennifer,
yeah, I think, you know, we're working with communities that are both struggling with, and from a historic preservation standpoint, struggling with the aftermath of disinvestment and trying to pick things up again, as well as communities that are trying to find that balance with a lot of market pressures. I've seen secret sauce, which I think is about great local leaders. A lot of those people are in this room. And good communication, like Justin said, really propels things forward. I like the secret sauce term because it makes me think of food, and I always say you have to keep taking your vitamins, because this is hard, complicated work, both on the physical side of things as well as the communication, bringing people along, having them understand the benefits of preservation. So and I think we've seen it both with after there's a challenging building save or a great investment by a developer, and then folks getting together and saying, what's next? What can we do to go beyond that individual building and go beyond? I've also seen it in communities like that we're dealing with, the proposed Northern Pass project or other big regional projects, where we've tried to help them see, and in the face of something big, how do you figure out what you really want and get the things in place to move forward with that vision?
So, Jen, you said some communities are still struggling with the aftermath of disinvestment. Do you mean years where LCHIP, the LCHIP fund was raided by the legislature?
Oh,
is that what you're
I
talking about?
I meant more broadly in terms of post-World War II, mills leaving and jobs changing, just the macro level economic threads that have gone through a lot of our communities.
Sure. Okay, your turn, Jared.
I would say communication, vision, education, and passion. Those really need to work together and kind of click in this big puzzle that's called preservation. And, you know, I think without one of them, you could be a little successful, but you really need to be able to educate the community on why you're doing this or why we need to do this. And I really would stress the we, because community is more than one individual, and you need to be able to have everybody have that community pride that they can say, this is our space, this is, you know, I consider the Belknap Mill part of my home. So that this is why, or a really strong contributor to making that secret sauce. I don't know if these are all the ingredients, they're the ones that really first come to mind for me personally, as really the heavy doses of what you need to get it accomplished.
Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Well, thinking of a secret sauce, it would go on a main dish. So I'll say something about the main dish, and that would be all the special places in New Hampshire that we care deeply about. And so along with the special sauce being all the people involved in the communication, for folks to be very clear about what they care about in their community, and to promote their resources and to talk among the community, but also with the business community, the political community, and the development community. I remember years ago I talked to a developer who explained that when he walked into, say, a planning board meeting or a select board meeting and said, I'm here because I want to preserve your local landmark, and this is what I want to do with it. He was received with open arms, and the process went well for him. But when he walked into a community that had that sense of where are the special places in our town, and said, I want to demolish your special place and put whatever type of new construction in, that's when he ran into trouble. So along with the secret sauce, the main dish is important as well.
One more question that came to my mind, and that is the next generation. As I said earlier, New Hampshire is an aging state, and I wonder, I'm going to start with you, Jared, how much do younger people care about getting involved with preserving these old buildings? And go ahead, Jared.
They care a tremendous amount because it's their home, or it's their adopted community, whether they're new to, you know, if we focus on New Hampshire specifically, if they're new to being residents here, they immediately are able to latch on to this strong community vibrancy, because you can't deny that every single town that we have here has its own unique flair that really draws and attracts individuals to be in that space, regardless of the age. But I think we're seeing more and more young professionals kind of merge into this preservation world because they're seeing the importance of preserving this, preserving our heritage, and really making sure that we can pass on a strong and integrated message to the next generation after this coming generation. So just finding ways that they can represent who they are and how they interact with the community really kind of plays a strong role, I think, with getting involved in the preservation world.
I like your thoughts, too, on this, Jennifer. We hear about millennials seeking attractive downtowns, seeking walkability, seeking authenticity, not just the same sort of cookie-cutter experience. So I wonder how much you see younger generations getting involved in preserving historic buildings.
Yeah, I think it's exciting that there is a next generation of people interested in heritage and place. coming up in the movement. It's when you think about how the next generation influenced major other social issues like recycling and smoking and things like that, we need the next generation in preservation. Yes, for authenticity, I think, and connectivity is in civic engagement, all relate to folks like Jared was describing. National studies reinforce that. Part of the whole kind of stay, work, play, keeping folks in New Hampshire. And I think we've seen it in all sectors kind of the movement, elected officials who are younger, who get it and want to be involved in preservation, folks working as consultants, private sector, public sector, and the craft part of this too is just incredibly important. We've got a great network of people who work on plaster, old stone walls, slate roofs, and it's we've seen it a lot through our work in barn preservation, a next generation of craftspeople coming along. So important to nurture that. Haven't really talked about that much, but obviously can't do the movement without that part of the group as well. So exciting and looking, want to support that so that more happens.
Well, it has been so great to be here again at the Belknap Mill in Laconia, and I really want to thank all of you, Jennifer Goodman, Jared Gilmet, Elizabeth Muzzy, and Justin Slattery. Thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
A couple other people I'd like to thank for making this event possible. From NHPR, Michael Brinley, Christina Phillips, Ellen Grimm, Patricia McLaughlin, Andrew Perella, RJ Perkins, Sarah Alger, Tim Brady, and Dan Tui. Also, a huge thank you to the Belknap Mill for hosting us. And of course, thanks to all of you for coming out tonight. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.